This is a podcast from the 2010 Nuffield Trust Annual Health Strategy Summit.
There's quite a lot to say. What I've done is I've put together a slide deck which broadly tries to explain why we've got to where we've got to and what I think the story is over the next decade. It's been a very, if you take a 30-year view, Britain discovered North Sea oil in the late 1970s and our tax base was flattered throughout the 80s and indeed the 90s by North Sea oil. And then our tax base was flattered from the mid-1990s to credit crunch by the bubble economy and credit growth of 10% a year. Everyone knows the story. Half the growth in British GDP between 97 and 2007 produced by financial services, property and construction. Interestingly, if you look at employment, half the employment growth in that period came from the public sector, of which the lion's share was produced by health. It's absolutely clear and that the next decade, Britain's going to have to work for its living. And it's not so much growth we're going to have to talk about, but development. And I think you've begun to see a change in the national conversation. I think it's very interesting that the Conservative Party commissioned James Dyson to deliver a report on how to boost British high value-added manufacturing, which in many respects echoes what Lord Mandelson has been talking about. Whoever wins the next election, Tory or Labour, there will be introduced into Britain a network of German-style Fraunhofer institutes. I'll talk a bit about those because they're going to impact quite a lot on the health sector in the decade ahead. James Dyson recommends them, Lord Mandelson recommends them, and you probably don't know what they are. But it is part of the thinking that I think is going to become more and more intense, that actually Britain has to develop its knowledge-intensive sectors. They're the ones which will lead us out of recession, and to do that requires developing a British innovation ecosystem. And if I can leave you with a couple of thoughts, and I'll start my slides in a second, it is that the health sector is a fundamental part of the British ecosystem. That some of the great technological innovations that are going to power growth in the 21st century are going to come in the health sector. That whilst the next 3, 4, 5 years are plainly going to be constrained, I'm absolutely sure that in 2020, health expenditure as a share of GDP will be higher than it is today, and GDP will be higher than it is today. And what has to be navigated is actually much better management of resource, refocusing of resource, and actually behavioral change. That, I think, is the story of the decade ahead. And there's huge open questions, actually we're quite ignorant about how some of that's going to be done. And so some of what I'm going to say is very speculative. And you must, you can assail me in the Q&A session and in the coffee break about that speculative nature of stuff. But anyway, let's begin. I don't think any of you, I certainly am astonished at the growth in the British banking sector. What you see there is from the late 1980s, early 1990s, bank assets as a share of GDP went from twice GDP to 5.5 times GDP. Some of that was the growth in sterling lending. An awful lot of that was because Britain developed its role as an international financial centre. We have in our four big banks, HSBC, Lloyds, Barclays and RBS, are all bigger than Citigroup or Bank of America. President Obama and Paul Volcker have both said how concerned they are about the size of Bank of America and Citigroup. They are far too big, they're complex financial institutions, they're far too big and really menace the American economy. They're very concerned about that in Washington. We have four banks bigger than Citigroup and Bank of America, and our economy is a tenth of the size. If bank assets were to carry on growing at the same rate that they grew in the last 15 years, in the next 10 or 15 years, and there was a second financial crisis, which, by the way, is nearly certain because of the inadequacy of the response. The talks about increasing the capital of banks are bogged down that the G20 commissioned in Basel. And the living wills is almost a comical response to what's taking place. It is interesting, isn't it, that that we had the spectacle of a Labour Chancellor on the Andrew Marr show on Sunday saying that he thought that it was a bit of a risk for David Cameron to unilaterally propose a levy on bank turnover to create an insurance fund. I think when the history of this is told, yes, I thought it was wonderful what Brown and Darling did in the October of 2008 when they did save the British banking system from collapse, and we would have had, there's no doubt actually, the four big banks would have gone because RBS was hours away from having to close its doors. I moved my money out of RBS. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I moved my money from RBS to HSBC, but even HSBC would have been, in a bank run when banks start to go, it would have fallen. That was a great moment. But actually, since then, the kind of lack of reform-minded zeal and the willingness, actually, to listen to the city saying we must allow our banks to grow, I think is a great dereliction of duty. And if our banks were to, in the next financial crisis, which will happen at some stage, because the banks remain undercapitalized and carry on doing their risky activity, the next financial panic will overwhelm the British state. We will be, one or two, I coined the phrase Reykjavik on Thames when, but this, I mean, it was slightly mocking, but the, indeed, I mean, we seriously will be Reykjavik on Thames. I mean, the Icelandics had, their bank assets, the share of GDP was just over 10. The Irish actually was slightly below 5.5 times. Look at mess they got themselves into. We can't carry on growing this way. Our banks have to, their balance sheets have to be steadied, and we have to have a period rather like the 1880 through to 1950 at this higher level. Because look at this next graph. Now, those of you at the back won't see the numbers, I warn you. Don't worry about it. Stay calm. This is a complicated graph. It comes from courtesy of McKinsey Global Institute. This one comes from my friend Andy Haldane at the Bank of England. But wait for this one. You ready? Take a deep breath. Ah! Yeah. What you've got to look at there, and don't look at the numbers, because it's a grab from a McKinsey Global Institute, and I couldn't take the numbers out of it, and I haven't rebuilt the thing without the numbers. What you need to look at is the column at the column at the left. Britain has got more private debt in relation to GDP than any other country in the world. And we know economists have a rough proxy that once private debt gets 3 times GDP and once public debt gets more than 90% of GDP, it starts to become problematic. We know that British private debt cannot grow. And we also know that from the previous slide about bank assets share GDP. So we know that residential mortgages aren't going to grow. We know, by the way, anyone thinking of buying a house, if you've got kids who are thinking of buying a house and you're worried about the condition of where the property market's going to take off, relax. The property market is going sideways for a hell of a long time. It'll be a miracle if we hold nominal prices at the current level. And my expectation is that house prices will take another downward lurch, actually. The Japanese got their private debt to 3 times more than GDP, and they spent 15 years of growing at less than 1% per annum as they've, lingo, deleveraged. And the only way they've got any growth at all is by allowing public debt to grow to only twice GDP. And we will have to have public debt in Britain going to 85-90% of GDP if we're not to have a lost decade like the Japanese. But the big point about this graph and why this is important for health professionals to get hold of is that every other country has also got high levels of private debt. And the rate of growth of private debt in the BRIC countries was running at, in Russia, it was 35% for nearly a decade. In Brazil, India and China, 15%. And what was happening in that decade up to the credit crunch was not just Britain, but actually the globe was going on a kind of credit bubble boom. I mean, the reason why world trade grew so much, the way China grew so much, because it could export to a world that was booming off the back of debt. I mean, the world had got a debt affliction. And we now know that a third of world GDP, the Americans, the Brits, the Spanish, the South Koreans, and the Japanese. And actually parts, curiously, although people don't talk about it, of the French and Swiss economies, commercial real estate and residential property, have got to deleverage. It's about a third of world GDP have got too much debt. So we know, actually, that the world is going to grow slowly in the decade ahead, unless there's a big increase in public spending and public borrowing. But the two countries that have done most of that, the Brits and the Americans, have got very high public debt to GDP ratios, and the Germans aren't in the game. We're in for a slow-growing decade. And this is just to give you a sense. We'll hear about this from Alistair Darling. GDP declined by 5% in 2009. That's the single biggest decline in GDP. That's the black line. That actually, we've encountered it. It was even faster decline of GDP in 2009 than it was in 1931. And we're bobbling along the bottom there. There's a risk we could do what we did in the 30s, have a double dip. I don't think we will, actually. I think that black line will trend up to here. This is months from the beginning of the recession. This black line will trend up like that. So there'll be a 12-month period in 2011 when growth will be 3%. And it might even continue into 2012. And budget statement. Today you'll learn that growth is going to be 1% in 2010, and then it'll be 3% in 2011. And there are a lot of people saying, "Whoa, optimistic forecasts." I mean, it's actually nearly certain that growth will be 3% in 2011. So when you hear George Osborne and Vince Cable saying it's an optimistic forecast, you can smile wryly. You've seen the graph. You know there will be 3% growth. After a devaluation we've had, quantitative easing, the biggest ever peacetime budget deficit, a world trade recovery, there will be a recovery like there's been in the big recessions in the last 100 years. So we will get. But that's just a bounce back. What's important is what happens after the bounce back. And that's where things start to get really serious. What I want to show you here is the kind of social bargain that's been taking place in Britain over the last decade, in which you in the health sector have been a very important part. The private sector doesn't generate any jobs in Britain. Hasn't generated jobs, any serious amount of jobs, for quite a while. Manufacturing has been taking jobs out. The service sector doesn't generate many jobs. And so what you have here is you have the percentage of, in various parts of the country, of what jobs have been generated by the public sector. Look at it. 78% of the jobs in the northeast, 75% in the northwest, 77% in Yorkshire, 200% in the West Midlands, 70% in the East Midlands, have come from the public sector. And the deal has been run a bubble economy of that explosive growth in bank assets, so that Britain has ended up being the debt capital of the world, have a property boom, have a construction boom, have a consumer boom, use the tax proceeds from that to spend on actually health and education, which actually creates the employment opportunities that the private sector does not. Because even in the middle of this credit boom that we've been taking place, the bits of the private sector that took off were not ones that actually were notably earning dollars or euro or yen from exporting. Britain has a very, very, very small part of its economy which actually earns dollars abroad. So as we stand, we have a 2%, leave aside the public deficit, the international deficit is about 2% of GDP. In 2020, even with the devaluation, most people think that so small has our traded goods sector become, both in services and manufacturing, that the current account deficit could be as high as 5% of GDP. Then when you have a recurring current account deficit of 5% of GDP, you can't finance it. You get into persistent currency weakness. It's what happens in Latin America. You get persistent inflation. The only way to avoid that is actually to build up our traded goods sector over the next decade. It is the alpha and omega of policy. we've got to lower the public sector deficit, the highest in peacetime history. We have to build up our trade goods sector, because this kind of social bargain can't be repeated. We can't get a tax yield in the way we have been getting to finance the kind of expenditure growth in health, education, and social and healthcare, social care, to create those employment opportunities. And there are many towns in Britain where, without a vigorous public sector, there's no employment prospects whatsoever. And you know that. There's 10 million people in the country who make less than 15,000 a year. And many of them are actually in the supply chain to the public sector. And many of them are actually in the public sector, which is very low paid. So, you know, and one of the reasons why we see the growth of, you know, the British Nationalist Party, UKIP, the English Defence League, and all the rest of it, is actually, you know, working class people in our communities know bloody well what's going on. I mean, you can see it out of the railway window if you in any northern town. You know, the only place which is employing anybody is the hospital or the colleges or the administration of the local authority. The private sector consists of retail sheds and warehouses on the edge of town connected up to the motorway network. The bits that used to produce in your town have been run down or sold off to foreigners. And you know there's not much opportunity for your kids. And, you know, that's what BNP councillors in Barking say. That's what the leader of the... And actually, what is the retort of our political class, left or right, to them? Because that's where we've kind of got the country to. So, the, you know, here is the prospect for the tough 2010s. I mean, the Treasury think that as much as 5%, and Barclays, working with IFS, think it could be as much as 10% of our GDP is just lost and gone forever, because it was all predicated upon there being a level of consumer demand that there won't be in the next decade, let alone the fact that the recession itself wiped out many companies and business models. The trend growth rate, trough to trough, is 2%, not the 2.75% the Treasury use, and not the 2.5% they'll use in the figures that will be published at lunchtime. The trend growth rate could even be lower than 2%. It could be 1.75%, Barclays think. And, you know, this comes in a country where we've got, you know, 3 million people economically inactive, 2.8 million people say they're idle, you've got unemployed of 2.5 million, and a world in which the public sector has created half the jobs in the last decade and cannot in the next decade, and a private sector that has a really poor record of being a job generator. And, you know, it's not a good scene, essentially. I wanted to show you this because I think the health sector is part knowledge economy. And actually, one of the ways, and indeed, Michael, when you was introducing this session, you know, you're seen as part of the problem. You know, you're seen as... you know, you're seen as a spender of resource. You're not seen as a wealth-generating sector in your own right. And if I can leave you with one thought, I think you are a wealth-generating sector in your own right. Because the knowledge economy led us out of the recession in the 1980s. That's the red line at the top there. The knowledge economy led us out of the recession in the 1990s. And it was the knowledge economy that leads us out, that will be the bit that's dynamic in the 2010s. What is the knowledge economy? The knowledge economy is the knowledge-intensive part. It's where, as the ESRC say, and there's lots of definitions of it, intangible assets, knowledge, skills, and innovative potential are the key resource. And when you define the knowledge economy, and here is a definition coming up, you can't read it, don't worry, at the back. Those will be on, we'll put these on the Nuffield website so you can see them, or you can distribute, print them off and distribute them this evening. Study it at leisure to put yourself to sleep tonight. But here's in the private sector all the things which are knowledge economy, knowledge intensive. I mean, high-tech manufacturing, the Dysons, the Rolls-Royces, nuclear power. And Britain's got a great space industry, by the way, with orders like which are 5 years out. That's part of knowledge economy. High-tech services, telecoms, ICT, financial services, business services, the culture and creative industries. But in the public sector, all the statisticians put health as one of the knowledge economy sectors. And whether it's what's going to happen to the pharmaceutical industry,
what's going to happen to the pace of innovation in drugs, what's going to happen to the pace of innovation in healthcare, where the management of health resources, in the processes by which health is done, that is all part of knowledge economy. That is wealth generating. Well-being and health don't just raise the productive potential of the people. They are sources of wealth in their own right. And I wanted to just put this topology up of what drives knowledge economy, because I want to place the demand story, because the demand for health is something we're going to have to think about as well as the supply of it when we think about health and knowledge economy. It's the interaction of extraordinary range of new technologies, general purpose technologies, with demand that actually is the heart of knowledge economy. I talk about general purpose technology, and what time is it? I'm just going to whip you through. I'll just talk to this slide. I was going to give you a list of general purpose technologies. General purpose technologies like the wheel or the railway or the internet or the internal combustion engine are the transformative technologies that actually have really pioneered human progress. There were two of them between 1400 and 1700. One was the printing press, the three-masted sailing ship. There were four of them between 1750 and 1900. There were eight of them between 1900 and 2000, including the computer and flight. There will be, in the 21st century, as many general-purpose technologies, transformative technologies, as there have been since 1450 in a century. And all the innovation theorists say that a good fifth, and some optimists say a third, of these transformative technologies will be in health. And some of the people in this room will know what they are. Use of virtual reality for diagnostic techniques, the uses of chips to enhance brain power, or kinds of ways of reproducing bodily functions but through technologies. Use of the genome to be able to kind of have individualized treatments, etc., etc., etc. They're going to be transformatory. And so your sector is going to be the load bearer of some of the most revolutionary advances in history of technological innovation in the next 60, 70, 80 years. It's absolutely certain. Also want to put this up, because this is also true of health. Because this is true, all organizations are spending more and more of their resource on R&D, non-scientific R&D, ICT, organizational software, leadership, management, and human capital development. That's what they're doing in the private sector. That's what should be happening in the public sector. That's what should be happening in health. Our great foundation trusts should be spending more and more of their annual budgets on intangibles and not on the tangibles. And I don't think many people in the health world, when I use these terms, know what I'm talking about. But the trend is absolutely clear. This is just to show you what a big share of GDP is spent on intangibles in all our leading economies. So I just want to round up now in a few slides and say something about health. Before I do, when Jennifer wrote to me and said, "Would I like to speak today?" It was meant to be the day before the publication of my book, Them and Us, which is in fact now going to be published in September and October. And what I argue in Them and Us is that the paradox of capitalism is that unless you run it fairly, it gets dysfunctional very fast. And I try to argue that actually, because the future is about this knowledge economy, it's whole societies that innovate. It's from whole societies that you get productive entrepreneurship. And it's, you have to run whole societies fairly. And I do think that two big stories in the next 10 years. One will be how we're going to earn our living and develop our economy and not get ourselves into a crisis on our international accounts. By the way, because I think it's almost impossible to develop our export sectors as quickly as we need to, and because the current account deficit will get so big. When I wrote the statement, I actually said, we have an over-financialized economy. It will end in tears unless you rein back the city, and there will be a big crisis. Everyone said, you know, well, you know, very nice to hear you, but actually financial services are the future. And, you know, I was politely, you know, regarded as an interesting and provocative maverick, but even I didn't think that the banking system would collapse, but I thought there would be big problems in parts of the financial sector, but not in all of it. And I'm now going to make another prediction. By 2020, given our international accounts, we will undoubtedly, if the euro survives, be trying to join the euro. Because it's almost the only way we can manage the kind of complex trade-offs, and it will be a Conservative government that leads us into the euro. Numbers don't lie, they have an inexorable, just like those banking numbers, you know, don't lie. We cannot grow the city anymore, because it would, if it went wrong, it would overwhelm us. So the numbers of international accounts and the small scale of our international traded goods sector just spell inexorable conclusions. But I want to say some things about health. Because health is part of the knowledge economy, I personally think that it will be a larger share of GDP in 2020 than it is now. But there are some really tricky things to be managed. I don't think that some of the extravagant claims about ring-fencing health can be met by any government. I mean, I think that the maximum that can be ring-fenced within the health budget is about 30%. I think the rest of it will be suffer the same very, very intense scrutiny that the rest of the public sector is having. I don't see how the wage bill can rise by more than 2% a year in nominal terms. So if you're going to get any real growth in the wage bill, and I've just played around with some numbers, but I think there will be about 100,000 job losses in the health service in the next period, I mean up to 2013-14. And you're going to be demand pressures are not going to reduce. So you know that is the orthodox picture, which everyone in the room knows. So I thought I would do is just, because you're looking at the programme, this is what you're going to be discussing in the next day and a half. Just try and have a helicopter view about some of the options I think that are open to the leaders in the health service. Now, in the public sector, in the debate about this, there's a great line from Eisenhower, which I really love. Now the money has run out, he famously said. We have to think. I do think that that is the challenge facing the public sector. And there are three basic, and I'd be to see what the audit commissioner has to say about this, actually. There are three basic generic ways which people approach public sector reform. There's the Institute of Government and Michael Bishod and team and others who talk, you know, we've got to do structural things to the to get efficiency. And one of the structural things often people talk to is the kind of dual leadership of many government departments, you know, a secretary of state and a permanent secretary, you know, who is the leader of a department. As a result, departments aren't properly led, and anyway, no one's there for long enough to actually drive change through, and there's no brownie points for being efficient. The brownie points are to have another initiative. And so what you have to do is you have to structurally change that. And some of the structural change, I think, in the health service has actually been rather effective. I'm rather in favour of foundation hospitals and foundation trusts. I'm rather in favour of polyclinics. But that's, you know, one answer to the exam question is structural. And when you have your debates and there'll be structuralists talking, I'm sure. Others talk to the managerialist school. You know, actually it's about getting a grip on the resources and making sure that they're allocated well. And to do that, it's about, you know, better performance metrics, better leadership, better management. It's essentially, it's the kind of the kind of McKinsey approach, if you like. This place can be better managed. And then there's the Young Foundation, Let a Thousand Flowers Bloom, or you know, Simon Jenkins in The Guardian. You know, localism is the answer to everything. And you emphasise local experimentation. Now, all these routes to efficiency actually are effective. They deliver results. The trouble with the structural thing is it's slow. The managerialist approach, I think, has... there's a kind of pushback from that after... There was a lot of low-lying fruit, I think, in the late 90s when Blair and the strategy unit and Michael Barber really got going. But as we all know, some of those performance metrics have produced perverse results, with hospital managers managing to reach the performance target rather than deliver quality healthcare. And letting a thousand flowers bloom, again, works, but actually you tend to find that actually it's hard to generalize it. And I wanted to put another framework on the table because I'm very, very interested in behavioral economics and the way that choice architectures can help change behaviors. I'm very interested indeed, I'm doubly interested in it because I think that the Conservative Party will be the largest single party in the next parliament. They may fall short of having an overall majority. And their thinkers are very interested in behavioural economics, and thus it's likely that our leaders in the next term parliament will be interested in talking about behavioural economics and choice architectures. The basic insight of behavioural economics is that people fall a long way short of being rational. They think it's because you have imperfect knowledge, for example, you tend to follow the crowd. It's rational, actually, to follow the crowd because it's so expensive to gather information up. Why actually bet against the crowd? It's why if one of you began to leave the room and another five did, you'd all do it, not knowing really why you were doing it, but thinking that the crowd was right and might know more than you did. The crowd, we are myopic, we are short-termist, and there's 101 ways, actually, in which kind of individuals' rationality is suboptimal. And the way that you help them make rational decisions or decisions that have rational outcomes for the system at large is to design choice architectures in which decision-making and the result of individual decisions, freely taken individual decisions, leads to better outcomes. And I'm going to run through some of those. And I also think that marrying it with a commitment to generating public value is a way of actually making very producer-oriented parts of our public sector much more aware of citizen preferences and responsive to citizen preferences at the heart of the decision-making. So if you can do two things, if you can make the people who run our health service, or indeed run our educational service, become more committed to the notion that actually responsiveness to citizen preference is the heart of what they're doing, and give them a toolkit of choice architectures in which they can help to design choices by citizens which lead to more optimal outcomes, you've got quite a powerful way of actually using resources better. I'm not saying that the other three ways of thinking about public sector efficiency are wrong, they're certainly not, but I want to put a fourth on the table, and a fourth which I think may produce quicker wins which are less controversial. Is there time to explain what public value is all about? It's 10 to 11. I should allow about, 15 minutes, 20 minutes for questioning? Let me just spend 30 seconds on this. The idea of this is that all of you providing a public service are in the business of actually identifying what it is that your citizens want, measuring it, creating it, obviously, and then managing the external environment get the outcomes that are thus, wanted and measured. I mean, the example I often give is of a librarian who finds that teenagers are using her library between 3:30 and 5, and it's not, that was even put there as latchkey kids between school and the parents getting home. What should she do? Should she say, this is a library, get out? Or there is, the citizens are expressing a different demand on a library, I better change the conception of what kind of value citizens want from a library. If she thinks the second thing, she has to start creating it, which may be creating a special section for the kids to be, and she's certainly got to manage authorising her external environment to get the resource and the permissions and buy-in to execute that change. She's not being bureaucratic. She's not saying the rules are the rules. She's actually proactively managing outward, managing her resources, and managing upward to be responsive to citizen preference. Now, that's a basic way of thinking about what you are doing if you run, you know, a polyclinic, if you run a foundation trust. That is what you're about. Now, let's put that together with behavioural economics. I think it's behavioural economists, I'm thinking they have five great clusters in which they think about getting behavioural change. One is to set a default option. The famous one we use in Britain is actually you will be opted into a stakeholder pension. And if you don't want to contribute to a stakeholder pension, you have to write to your employer and tell her that you want out. The default option is that you're in. Now, behavioural economy, this is a very, very, very powerful tool. I mean, should the default option be that you use NHS Direct before you go to your GP? I mean, and just think of the potential savings that could, and resource efficiencies and all the rest of it that would throw up. How you get to that can only be, I think, if you use the discourse of public value. Then information. I mean, devastating behavioural change. In Los Angeles, behavioural economists advise the kind of LA authorities that one of the best ways of improving restaurant hygiene was to kite mark every restaurant, and for that kite mark to be published on the menu at the outside of the restaurant, so that anyone going in to eat would actually see what the hygiene standards were of the restaurant concerned. The impact on the quality of hygiene and the quality and the number of kind of stomach complaints and the rest of it reported in the LA, you know, fell by a precipitate amount. Similarly, hotels that tell their clientele that most other people in the hotel are agreeing not to have their towels and linen washed and will use them a second and third time. If you tell the people coming into your hotel that that's what others are doing and that is understood to be the norm, most residents of hotels will say, okay, I will use the same linen and towel for a second and third night to save water, to save the planet, or whatever. You get very powerful behavioural change. Self-contracting is another very, very powerful technique, and you can incentivise self-contracting. I mean, if you invite people to set targets for weight loss, less cigarette consumption, less alcohol consumption, and actually reward them for meeting their self-contracting targets, you get incredible behavioural change. One of the best ways of promoting cycle use is to design cities in which there's lots of cycle paths and lots of places to store cycles. One of the best ways of getting effective use of resource in hospitals and actually cutting out, you know, kind of wasting nursing time is actually clever design. Clever design of everything from, you know, beds through... And the Design Council have launched a very interesting campaign, Design Bugs Out, which is in collaboration with NHS, has produced quite a lot of interesting new design. You know, just getting designers to think about, you know, I want this, whatever it might be, used in a different kind of way, or I want it to be easier to clean. Please think about how it's designed so that will happen. You get the behavioural change. And then last and not least is your social norms. Now, I think behavioural economics and the choice architectures, I'm certain that all around the country there are managers and clinicians using these techniques without knowing that it's behavioural economics and getting some fantastic outcomes. And I think a great piece of work to do would be to do a serious audit of it and actually make it more systematic. I also think we're going to have to think about much more flexibility in job roles. In the knowledge economy, where things are knowledge intensive and where skill sets become superseded or they get added to. By the way, I was very strongly in favour of when nursing went up, you know, the degree for nursing that was announced recently, you know, about the mockery on the Today programme and in the right-wing press about, you know, you'd have to go to Balliol to be a nurse, you know, and all you want is a kind of big-bosomed, friendly nurse. Actually, nursing is, as everyone knows, is highly knowledge-intensive. And actually, the necessity of actually, is, as you would expect in a knowledge economy sector, and actually there's going to be big changes in job roles, definitionally. And the NHS are going to have to demand more contractual flexibility from its staff about where they work, how they work, what skills they deploy. And I think there has to be a new workplace bargain in which we have to really help people. This is not just... And it can be done, I think, within an organisation employing 1.6 million people, but better, more at large even, having better income insurance and guarantees to help people transition from one job to another, really invest in their lifelong learning, and actually try and develop an internal labour market in the NHS in which people can, if jobs are at risk, there can be maybe a de facto job guarantee offered by being able to work elsewhere, you know, either in a city or in a region, and for that actually to be accepted as the quid pro quo for getting real wage growth. So, in conclusions, I mean, just to rattle these off, and I'll stop down. There will be an increase in health in demand. You're going to, I think, have to use public resource more efficiently, but I am certain that by 2020, this country will have developed co-financing techniques to get private sector funds into the into our health regime. I would expect 10% of GDP or more to be spent on health in 2020, 9% from our tax base, and the last 1% of GDP from the private sector. And how to do that in a way that is equitable, and to bring private insurance into the health system is going to be one of the political challenges of the decade. I think there will be more emphasis on preventative health and smart use of diagnostic and clinical techniques. One thing I haven't talked about is I think there's going to be a big transformation in the pharmaceutical industry. I think we're going to see a growth, and I think the NHS should use its procurement to drive a new generation of smart but micro pharma companies rather than the big pharma companies. I was talking to Herman Hauser of Amadeus Partners, who's been work on these Fraunhofer Institutes for Peter Mandelson yesterday. I'm one of the kind of pro bono advisors to the Department of Business on this knowledge economy stuff. And he's saying that actually in our universities and one of the big things we do very well in Britain is actually stem cell work and all that, and that there's some amazing advances, in, not just in Cambridge, but in clinics around the country. He was saying that actually that these Fraunhofer Institutes, which are... If you, the Americans have a lovely ranking, you know, one is where an intellectual idea comes out of a lab, nine is its commercial applicability. We are very good in Britain at one and two. We are very good at eight and nine. The trouble is bridging from two to eight, that those steps between two and eight where an idea or a scientific advance. And the idea of these institutes is to be a new intermediate institution who will do just that. We're going to, he would like to create 50 of them. And they would become interlocutors with the our medical laboratories in actually translating some of these kind of new advances into you know, drugs and treatments, which are likely to be better done with small pharmaceutical companies than with big ones. Do think creatively about behavioural change. There will be a new workplace bargain. I actually think that some of this is actually rather positive. I mean, I think there might be, in 2012, 2013, it's going to be very difficult because there's not time to get some of this stuff in place. But I do think the second half of the decade, as some of these interventions come through, could be very positive indeed. I mean, Britain has got, whether it's NHS Direct, whether it's our pharmaceutical industry, actually whether it's the NHS itself, these are very effective ways of doing health in the emergent knowledge economy. And actually the challenge, I think, is actually to stop thinking of health as a spender of taxpayers' resource, but to reconceptualize it as a critical part of Britain's emergent knowledge economy, and a crucial way, by the way, by the 2020s, of employing people who are going to be providing services to people in other countries who will pay us yen and dollar and euro if we haven't joined it, and narrow our current account deficit. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.